Access your number 11237, reel 5.
Admiral Morgan Giles, reel 5.
He got the farm going, but the farm was a financial failure, and so he went into the gold mines in South Africa and worked there for a great many years, until World War II, in fact. In the course of this very adventurous life, he was tattooed almost from head to foot. And when he came back to the Admiralty, full of patriotic fervour, in 1939, the chap was interested and said, "Oh, nice to see you, Pearson. Long time since we've seen you. What have you been doing there?" And he said, "As a matter of fact, I've been doing a lot of mining." The very chap, "We're having awful trouble with the mines in the Suez Canal," so they sent him out there, and that's all he knew about it. And he really didn't seem to know much about the 20th century at all, but he was an absolutely delightful old man. Anyway, he joined this planning staff in for this disinformation thing about Sardinia. And he and I were told to drive a truck we had, which we valued very much, from Cairo to Algiers, all across the desert, all the way. But at the last minute, I wasn't allowed to go with him, and he had to go with one sailor, I think, and drive to Algiers. And I was put in an aircraft to go to Algiers. And this was a thing called a Hudson. And we got as far as what they called the Marble Arch, which was one of the landing grounds in the Western Desert, where a great big concrete arch had been put up by Mussolini when he intended to march into Egypt. We landed and refueled at Marble Arch, and as we all got in the aircraft and thundered down the runway to take off, the thing took an appalling swerve, which, before it was airborne, which the Hudsons were apt to, for various technical reasons, and lurched sideways so much that both the oleo legs, which supported the undercarriage, broke off, pushed through into the petrol tanks, woomph, woomph, and the aircraft was on fire as we slithered to a standstill. Luckily, the back door opened instead of jamming, which they did sometimes, and out stepped two wrens, a sub-lieutenant, a lieutenant commander, a captain, and an admiral in that order. And we stood and watched the aircraft burning, and the metal burning, it was so hot, the actual aluminum and whatever, magnesium, whatever they built out of, burning, and all our kit, all our suitcases, everything we possessed, the passports, everything in it. And there we were, standing in the middle of the desert in our khaki shorts. Anyway, of course, there were plenty more aircraft, and we flew on to Algiers, and we had an interesting time in Algiers, planning for this, in fact, completely spurious operation in Sardinia. Well, I was some weeks or a month or two in Algiers doing this planning. It wasn't very interesting, but I was taken out of that and put into a French destroyer called Le Fantasque. And this was a magnificent, great flotilla leader thing, they called it, sort of halfway between a destroyer and a cruiser. A 43-knot ship, beautiful ship. There were three of them, but this was Le Fantasque. She had been interned in Dakar. She'd been decided to join the Free French and ourselves, and she'd been sent across to America, kitted out with a quadruple Bofors and radar and all sorts of things, and sent back into the Mediterranean. But of course, they didn't know our way of doing things, and they were operating under British Commander in Chief's orders, and they had to have a liaison officer with them to interpret their signals for them and explain the way things went. So I was sent to this ship, and I and I think one signal rating were the only Englishmen on board, and they all spoke French, and so we just had to. I didn't enjoy it very much. They were frightfully behind operationally. Just as an example, we found at the beginning of the war that ladders up through a ship from one deck to the next which are always vertically above one another because the hatches are above one another so the stores can be hoisted in and out, were always on hooks. so that pre-war you just unhook them, take them out of the way when you want to raise and lower hoist in stores or lower down stores. We found very early in the war that when there was a near miss or anything, a bomb or a mine nearby or anything like that, everything would jump, and these ladders would unhook themselves, you see, and fall down. The lights would go out, perhaps, and then there were perhaps 100 sailors running around the mess deck trying to get out, and there's no way to get up. They could either get up to escape them, to escape, or to save their lives, or to man their guns, or anything. So very early in the war, instead of these hooks, they were just bolted up, and that stopped them unhooking when there was a near miss, and they were always there. But it merely meant if you want to use them, get them out of the way for stores, you just had to unbolt instead of unhooking. And that was such an elementary thing, just in the same way, you know, as telephones in all the big ships were designed so that a near miss would unhook them, so that the telephone operator, who'd been just sitting there doing just about nothing, suddenly every light on his board would come on, all starting humming simultaneously, because every receiver jumped off, and there was the commander furiously trying to ring up somebody to get a fire put out or something, and of course he couldn't get answered. So that was very, very simply arranged in HMS Vernon, the torpedo school, which was responsible for electrics in those days, by just putting a little catch on so they didn't hop off. But the French had none of these ideas, and I said to them, hoping to be constructive and polite, look here, it'd be a good idea to bolt your ladders and that sort of business. But no way they would wish to take advice. No way. And I'm not saying this to criticize the French, because they did some fine things, but we were sent into Bizerta once to collect fresh water. And a signal came back saying, go inside the inner basin and take it from such a tanker that's in there. And the captain said, oh, we're not going to go in and get it. Big ships have it brought out to them, and we're a big ship. And there was an impasse for several days. He was too proud to go in and get it for himself. Silly, but I think it's very well known that there were difficulties in dealing with the French, and no doubt they found their situation very difficult to deal with us. That didn't last very long, and I came out of that and was then forthwith sent to an Italian destroyer called the Legionario with similar duties, because by this time the invasion, Italy had made its armistice, and some of their forces were working with us. I only spent a very short time with them, just a trip or two. We used to dart out and take people somewhere or do a bombardment or something, and another very high speed ship. But one thing I remember was that the ships, although so fast and magnificent technically in a way, were very lightly built, and they would spend the entire time they were out at action stations on deck. Nobody ever dreamt of going below. It wasn't thought to be safe to go below. They'd have meals served to them at their gun stations, and they all wore fully blown up life jackets the entire time they were at sea. Of course, it's a completely different philosophy. Instead of having an Atlantic Navy, they had a Mediterranean Navy, which had to dart out and do an operation and go back in again. They were, I thought, better seamen than the French. And they were less excitable than the French. The French were frightfully excitable. The French spent almost a complete outfit of ammunition firing at their own splashes from this Bofors one night, I remember. But the Italians, I thought, were better chaps in some ways. Of course, I suppose they'd had more wartime experience. Another thing about the Italian ships was that they were so lightly built that they were not terribly reliable. And occasionally, if you were on the bridge, you'd look over the side and you'd see you were slowing down and then stopped. And it was such a routine thing that the engine room didn't seem to bother to ring up the bridge and say why it was or what had happened or anything. And then there'd be clanking noises in the boiler room after a bit. You'd look and you'd see you've got going again. Most extraordinary. And it made me think at the time, well, I don't know that I've ever, ever been actually involuntarily stopped at sea, except through enemy action, in a Royal Navy ship, except once when the old HMS Cornwall out in China steamed into such a huge, huge flock of jellyfish that she sucked gigantic jellyfish into all her condenser intakes and came to a standstill. But that's another story. And I was only in that Italian ship for a very short time.
What did the attitude of the Italian sailors seem to be towards the war and the opposing sides at that time?
Absolutely reconciled. They didn't seem to, bother. In fact, it was. I heard an illustration of that many years later when I was in Trieste, and my wife's on the train with some Italians, and one of these chaps was talking to her, and he said, "You know, I don't know how we came to lose the war. We fought on everybody's sides." But they weren't in any way bitter. Next very short job I had was to go to the Salerno landings in charge of a small unit of landing craft infantry. And the landing craft infantry would carry 200 troops. And we had, I think I had three or four of these little ships. And I was told to embark these chaps and a whole mass of small arms ammunition and go up to the Italian coast, go into Salerno for my final orders, and then go on up to the mouth of the Tiber and sail right up the Tiber with these shallow draft American-built landing craft and get up as far as I could up, because this 82nd American Airborne Division, which these troops came from, was going to be parachuted or airdropped over Rome, and these were their reinforcements and more ammunition for them. And I said, "What about getting under the bridges?" "Oh, the partisans will blow the bridges up." And I didn't think this sounded very good, so we cut down our masts in these landing craft to be all ready to do it. And off we set for this rather harebrained operation. But when we got into Salerno and asked for a confirmation to go on, they said, "Oh no, that operation's been cancelled now. Just land them on the beach here." So we landed them at the Salerno beaches.
What impression did you get of the Salerno landings?
At Salerno?
What impression did you get of those landings at Salerno?
Those landings? Well, it was very disorganized from our point of view, because we were a small ship and we hadn't got the orders for the Salerno landings. And so I know that I was steaming this lot into a minefield once when a friend of mine who was the navigator of HMS, one of the cruisers, sent me a signal saying, "You're steaming into a minefield." So we went somewhere else. It was quite disorganized, but we're only a very small unit. And we were not fired at. We went in at night and we were not fired at. It was very early in the piece. Well, by this time, of course, the British forces were well engaged in going up Italy, or fighting their way slowly up Italy. And from Algiers, I was sent back to Cairo. Now, at that time, the Italian had surrendered in Yugoslavia, and Yugoslavia was in a ferment, ready to rise up and drive out the Germans who'd been occupying them for so long. The Italians were already gone. They sent the Italians home without their rifles and without their trousers, because they said those were the only useful things about them. And nobody knew whether to rally to Marshal Tito's banner or to Mihailovic's banner. And the most extraordinary stories were coming out about Tito in particular. And some said there was no such thing as Tito. Some people said it was a committee of Soviet from Russia. Some people said that it was a glorious, blonde-headed, Boadicea figure leading countrymen against the invaders and all that sort of thing. And Churchill said, "I can't understand what's happening. Send somebody in to find out." And so he chose a young former diplomat, now soldier, called Fitzroy Maclean, who I've mentioned a bit earlier on, who had the advantage of speaking Russian as well as other languages. And he went back from Cairo as an army captain and came back 5 days later as a brigadier, and was every inch a brigadier, and yet gave no offense to his old friends, and was a very remarkable man in every way and a very impressive figure as a 29-year-old brigadier. He was sent to Tito. He went in on a parachute. He met Tito. They had a lot of drink together, and they got on absolutely famously from the very beginning. Another much more elderly man, whose name I forget, was sent in to Mihailovic. He landed the wrong way up. He sprained his ankle. He couldn't find Mihailovic. He didn't get on with Mihailovic when he got there, and that sort of business. So all the propaganda, especially from the BBC, began to switch itself over to Tito. It's one of the big ifs of history. Suppose those brigadiers had been sent to the other one, but that's not what we're talking about now. Fitzroy Maclean, when he was sent in charge of this mission, was told by Churchill to have anybody and whoever he wanted and anything he wanted. And he asked me to go as his naval liaison officer. This was all from Cairo, because there was a strange carve-up of responsibilities, that anything that happened in the Balkans was organized from Cairo. Anything that happened in Italy was organized from Algiers. It was just a sort of command boundary down there. So we were really regarded as Cairo people. He asked for me. I said, all right, but what do you want a naval liaison officer for if you're prowling around the mountains for Tito? And he said, because this man Tito has got an immense movement going there, and people are flocking to his banner, and it's no good just going across in the moonlight and dropping them a few sacks of Sten guns or explosive cowpats, which you used to send them to blow the wheels off the German lorries and so on. They want more than that. They'll have to have supplies sent to them in a big way. So I said, well, that's fine, I get that, and they've got to come by sea, but it's not my learning to ride a broomstick and coming in with you and sitting in the mountains and beckoning to the mist for supplies that don't come. I better go to Italy and send the stuff across to you. Set up a gun-running organization there. And he said, that makes sense. So I went to Bari with my requirements, which are a few high-speed boats, some radio, a few motorbikes, and, you know, just to run a little enclave, really, of Cairo responsibility in the office of Naval Officer in Charge, Bari, running a gun-running organization across to Tito. Well, I set this up, and I found that one could go across to the islands, and the islands had been taken back by the partisans when the Italians left, and there was a sort of dead heat between them and the Germans, which owned which island. Often adjacent islands in different hands, and then they were attacking one another and fighting to and fro. I sent huge quantities of supplies across there. Every night we'd send speedboats across, MTBs, MLs, and things like that across there, and the partisans would take this stuff and then load and distribute them in their own fishing boats and put them on the backs of mules and take them up into the mountains or wherever they were wanted, you see. And I used to go across and see how they were received and what was wanted and that sort of thing. And one night we were caught by a gale, and we had to spend 2 or 3 days on some little rocky island, living in a peasant's hut, fisherman's hut. And I was in this hut, and they'd got a radio receiver out of a crashed Italian bomber hooked up to an old battery out of a truck, and they were listening to the BBC Overseas Service. And it was in Serbo-Croat, and of course I couldn't understand it. But it then said Yugoslavi. And then the announcement began, and all about Tito. And I've never known a more electric atmosphere in any little room in my life. These chaps are absolutely intent on every word being said about their war in Yugoslavia. And it was all about Tito. And I'm sure that the influence of the BBC Overseas Service then did a massive amount to create Tito, really, because anybody that heard that would say Tito's the chap and go across and move across the Tito camp. The passions which were aroused in that war in Yugoslavia were, of course, fantastic, and just to sum it up, I believe I'm right that out of the 11 million population of Yugoslavia at the beginning of the war, When the war finally ended, there were 1¾ million missing. 3/4 of them taken over by the enemy as slave labour and shot as hostages and that sort of thing, and the other million done down fighting between themselves. And that's a pretty terrible statistic. But that's the degree of feeling the boss there. Well, this gun running went on for a good long time, for the winter months, and just before Christmas of 43, or just at Christmas of 43, there was this huge air raid on Bari, and I was in Bari harbour that night when 18 ships were sunk and 1,000 men killed by one raid, and I was standing in the bar when this thing happened in the Albergo Imperiale, and we heard the Beauforts began to sort of grunt away, and obviously there must be an exercise, I hadn't heard about that, but it wasn't, it was this fantastic air raid. This was the occasion, you will remember, when a tanker was hit, and then an ammunition ship blew up and scattered mustard gas, which we were ready to use, had the enemy used it, all over the surface of the oil floating in the harbour, and it was one of the most, I suppose, from the enemy point of view, one of the most successful air raids ever undertaken. Anyway, this was during my gun running time. And then one night, I would say, I don't remember the exact date, but just one of the first few days of January 1944, there was a big battle over in the Yugoslav islands between our own motor torpedo boats and our own destroyers due to mistaken identity. And both lots came steaming back to, and Bari said they had hell of a battle, and they realized they'd been shooting one another. And the local admiral in charge then, who was Admiral McGregor, who afterwards became First Sea Lord, said, "This is ridiculous. There are enough people to fight without fighting one another. We must send somebody over to Yugoslavia to take charge of the operations there in the islands, because it's too detailed to be done by remote control from Italy, evidently, do you see?" And they got another retread, a Captain Black, who was going to be sent over, and he had a team, a cipher office team, and a complete little operations, minor operations headquarters. And he got in a motor smash the night before he was supposed to go across.
He got what?
He got in a motor smash the night before he was supposed to go across. Well, they said, "Well, Morgan Giles has been over there a bit. Hook him out of his hotel and send him across with this team of Captain Blacks, and get the thing established over there, and then Captain Black can go and relieve him after a week when his leg is better." Well, luckily for me, Captain Black's leg didn't get better, and I had a year over there instead of a week. And a very interesting time it was. When one got across there, one found that the motor torpedo boats had been lying in caves when they could find them, and putting their radio aerials up on boat hooks through a hole in the roof of the cave to try and get their orders for the next night and that sort of thing. So there was no wonder that their operational control was very confused, to say the least. The partisans were operating a few boats as well, and there was that problem. And the arrangements for getting into, you never really knew which island was in the hands of which force, or whether been fighting during the day and the little port had changed hands or something. And so there were extraordinarily complicated arrangement of signals, and they didn't have, the partisans had no equipment, not one man in 1,000 had a wristwatch, so it was very difficult to do any sort of formal planning or anything with them. They had no radios. They hadn't got any coloured lights for letting you into the port or anything, and they just used to have strange certain number of shots on a rifle to know if it was safe to go in or not, and that sort of thing. So one went across there. I remember the first, we were sent to an island called Vis, V-I-S, which is just off Split, which is one of the outermost islands. The partisan headquarters there welcomed us and gave us a billet in the house, quite nice modern house of a sardine manufacturer. We set up our ops room there, and the first night I landed in this little port called Camisa, there was a huge bonfire going, and all the partisan girl soldiers were there singing, and it was just like going to a comic opera, really. It was like going to the opera, most extraordinary, dramatic. Anyway, we got established there, And the motor torpedo boats were sent across to me when they were ready for operations. I would get information from the partisans as to where they were to be, as to where the enemy were expected to be, because you see the strategic situation was that the enemy still had troops in Crete and in Greece, and they were trying to supply them, and they couldn't get them through the Balkans because partisan activity, especially in Yugoslavia, was such that they couldn't get their road convoys through and so on, and largely the German garrisons were wired into the towns with a string of wire and mines around them and down go out into the countryside. So they tried to send stuff down by sea, and of course the only way to get down by sea was through the islands where we were, so we could go up to the hill on the top of Vis Island and look out over, and we'd see where the battle would take place that night 3 miles away. Every man's hand in Yugoslavia was turned against the enemy, against the Germans. They the old women who did their laundry would stack some firewood for them. The various intelligence organizations, SOE and so on, would have sent from Cairo to the partisans firewood logs which had explosive inside them. And so the old woman who was doing their laundry would say, well, some nice firewood for you, dears. Have a, you know, warm-up tonight. And when the German officer was sitting around their mess, chucked a particular log on the fire, whoomph, there we go. Explosive cowpats that they used to put on the roads, which I've just mentioned, all sorts of strange devices like that. And the Germans were really having a pretty horrible time. There, to put the Mihailovich thing into the picture, Mihailovich had faded from the picture now, because he, having, poor chap, having been left behind by the Yugoslav government to preserve some sort of continuity of resistance in the traditional way, fighting from the mountains, when the government came out, as you know, from Kotor on a British submarine, he had had no news, no information, no gold, no support of any sort, and had come to the end of his tether, and there's no doubt had reached local accommodation with the Germans. You don't chase me beyond a certain line and I won't snipe your sentries, sort of thing. And I think Mihailovich had one of the very raw deals of history, really.
Do you think that he had been doing fighting before that?
Insofar as he could, but not effectively. Whereas Tito, you see, as we know, had been the head of the illegal Communist Party in Yugoslavia before the war, and he had a perfect organization of contacts and cadres and so on throughout the land of his communists, but he lay low for a couple of years, you see, from the German invasion of 1941 until 1943, before he really began fighting, when he... And Churchill's edict, which is the thing underlying this entire operation, was that everything possible should be done to help Tito. Largely, I may say, because of the favourable reports about Tito sent home by Fitzroy Maclean in impeccable Foreign Office telegram saying what a splendid chap Tito was and how well he was doing. And there's no doubt Tito was an incredibly charismatic figure. I'll talk about in a minute. Fitzroy Maclean also got Randolph Churchill, who loved adventure, to come in with him, and took him to see Tito. Took him to see Tito, and then of course Randolph Churchill used to send further missives home to his father saying what ought to happen and what a splendid chap Tito was. And if Tito by the fireside one night would say we ought to do this, we ought to do this, Randolph would get this home to Churchill, and within about a week it would be done. And so Tito thought that Fitzroy and Randolph Churchill between them were absolute wonder workers, as indeed they were. So reverting to the naval side of this, my job was to operate the